Just push the big mirror over here, will you? Golder got to his feet and shuffled across to the forge, which was now cold. The strand of magic still writhed, though, at once present and not present, like a slit cut into another universe full of hot blue light. He picked it up easily, took a longbow from a rack, said a word of power, and watched with satisfaction as the magic grasped the ends of the bow and then tightened until the wood creaked. Then he selected an arrow. Trumon had tugged a heavy full-length mirror into the middle of the floor. "When I am head of the Order," he told himself, "I certainly won't shuffle around in carpet slippers." Trumon, as mentioned earlier, felt that a lot could be done by fresh blood if only the dead wood could be removed. But just for the moment he was genuinely interested in seeing what the old fool would do next. He may have derived some satisfaction if he had known that Golder and Skrelt Change Basket were both absolutely wrong. Golder made a few passes in front of the glass, which clouded over and then cleared to show an aerial view of the Forest of Skund. He looked at it intently while holding the bow with the arrow pointing vaguely at the ceiling. He muttered a few words like, "Allow for wind and speed of, say, 3 knots," and "Adjust for temperature," and then with a rather disappointing movement, released the arrow. If the laws of action and reaction had anything to do with it, it should have flopped to the ground a few feet away, but no one was listening to them. With a sound that defies description, but which for the sake of completeness can be thought of basically as spang plus 3 days' hard work in any decently equipped radiophonic workshop, the arrow vanished. Golder threw the bow aside and grinned. "Of course, it'll take about an hour to get there," he said. "Then the spell will simply follow the ionized path back here. To me." "Remarkable," said Trumon. But any passing telepath would have read in letters 10 yards high, "If you, then why not me?" He looked down at the cluttered workbench, where a long and very sharp knife looked tailor-made for what he suddenly had in mind. Violence was not something he liked to be involved in except at one remove, but the Pyramid of Sort had been quite clear about the rewards for whoever brought all 8 spells together at the right time, and Trumon was not about to let years of painstaking work go for nothing because some old fool had a bright idea. "Would you like some cocoa while we're waiting?" said Golder, hobbling across the room to the servant's bell. "Certainly," said Trumon. He picked up the knife, weighing it for balance and accuracy. "I must congratulate you, Master. I can see that we must all get up very early in the morning to get the better of you." Golder laughed, and the knife left Trumon's hand at such speed that, because of the somewhat sluggish nature of disc light, it actually grew a bit shorter and a little more massive as it plunged with unerring aim towards Golder's neck. It didn't reach it. Instead, it swerved to one side and began a fast orbit, so fast that Golder appeared suddenly to be wearing a metal collar. He turned around, and to Trumon it seemed that he had suddenly grown several feet taller and much more powerful. The knife broke away and shuddered into the door, a mere shadow's depth from Trumon's ear. "Early in the morning," said Golder pleasantly. "My dear lad, you will need to stay up all night." "Have a bit more table," said Rincewind.
"No, thanks, I don't like marzipan," said Twoflower. "Anyway, I'm sure it's not right to eat other people's furniture."
"Don't worry," said Swires. "The old witch hasn't been seen for years. They say she was done up good and proper by a couple of young tearaways."
"Kids of today," commented Rincewind.
"I blame the parents," said Twoflower.
Once you had made the necessary mental adjustments, the gingerbread cottage was quite a pleasant place. Residual magic kept it standing, and it was shunned by such local wild animals who hadn't already died of terminal tooth decay. A bright fire of licorice logs burned rather messily in the fireplace. Rincewind had tried gathering wood outside, but had given up. It's hard to burn wood that talks to you. He belched.
"This isn't very healthy," he said. "I mean, why sweets? Why not crisp bread and cheese?" Or salami. Now, I could do with a nice salami sofa.
Search me, said Swires. Old Granny Whitlow just did sweets. You should have seen her meringues.
I have, said Rincewind. I looked at the mattresses.
Gingerbread is more traditional, said Twoflower.
What, for mattresses?
Don't be silly, said Twoflower, reasonably. Whoever heard of a gingerbread mattress?
Rincewind grunted. He was thinking of food, more accurately, of food in Ankh-Morpork pork. Funny how the old place seemed more attractive the further he got away from it. He only had to close his eyes to picture in dribbling detail the food stalls of 100 different cultures in the marketplaces. You could eat squishy or shark's fin soup so fresh that swimmers wouldn't go near it. And,
do you think I could buy this place? Said Twoflower.
Rincewind hesitated. He'd found it always paid to think very carefully before answering Twoflower's more surprising questions.
What for? He said cautiously.
Well, it just reeks of ambience.
Oh.
What's ambience?
Said Swires, sniffing cautiously and wearing the kind of expression that said he hadn't done it, whatever it was.
I think it's a kind of frog, said Rincewind. Anyway, you can't buy this place because there isn't anyone to buy it from.
I think I could probably arrange that on behalf of the Forest Council, of course,
interrupted Swires, trying to avoid Rincewind's glare.
And anyway, you couldn't take it with you. I mean, you could hardly pack it in the luggage, could you?
Rincewind indicated the luggage, which was lying by the fire and managing in some quite impossible way to look like a contented but alert tiger, and then looked back at Twoflower. His face fell.
Could you? He repeated.
He had never quite come to terms with the fact that the inside of the luggage didn't seem to inhabit quite the same world as the outside. Of course, this was simply a byproduct of its essential weirdness. But it was disconcerting to see Twoflower fill it full of dirty shirts and old socks, and then open the lid again on a pile of nice crisp laundry smelling faintly of lavender. Twoflower also bought a lot of quaint native artifacts, or, as Rincewind would put it, junk. And even a 7-foot ceremonial pig-tickling pole seemed to fit inside quite easily without sticking out anywhere.
"I don't know," said Twoflower. "You're a wizard. You know about these things."
"Yes, well, of course, but baggage magic is a highly specialised art," said Rincewind. "Anyway, I'm sure the gnomes wouldn't really want to sell it. It's he groped through what he knew of Twoflower's mad vocabulary. It's a tourist attraction."
"What's that?"
said Swires interestedly.
"It means that lots of people like him will come and look at it," said Rincewind.
"Why?"
"Because..." Rincewind groped for words. "It's quaint. Oldie-worldy. Folkloresque. It's a delightful example of a vanished folk art steeped in the traditions of an age long gone."
"It is?"
said Swires, looking at the cottage in bewilderment.
"Yes."
"All that?"
"Afraid so."
"I'll help you pack."
And the night wears on, under a blanket of lowering clouds which covers most of the disk. Which is fortuitous, because when it clears, and the astrologers get a good view of the sky, they are going to get angry and upset. And in various parts of the forest, parties of wizards are getting lost and going round in circles, and hiding from each other and getting upset, because whenever they bump into a tree it apologizes to them. But unsteadily though it may be, many of them are getting quite close to the cottage. Which is a good time to get back to the rambling buildings of Unseen University, and in particular the apartments of Greyhald Spold, currently the oldest wizard on the disk, and determined to keep it that way. He has just been extremely surprised and upset. For the last few hours he has been very busy. He may be deaf and a little hard of thinking, but elderly wizards have a very well-trained survival instinct, and they know that when a tall figure in a black robe and the latest in agricultural hand tools starts looking thoughtfully at you, it is time to act fast. The servants have been dismissed. The doorways have been sealed with a paste made from powdered mayflies, and protective octagrams have been drawn on the windows. Rare and rather smelly oils have been poured in complex patterns on the floor, in designs which hurt the eyes and suggest the designer was drunk, or from some other dimension, or possibly both. In the very centre of the room is the 8-fold octagram of withholding, surrounded by red and green candles.
and in the centre of that is a box made from wood of the curly fern pine, which grows to a great age, and it is lined with red silk and yet more protective amulets. Because Greyhald Spold knows that death is looking for him, and has spent many years designing an impregnable hiding place. He has just set the complicated clockwork of the lock and shut the lid, lying back in the knowledge that here at last is the perfect defence against the most ultimate of all his enemies, although as yet he has not considered the important part that air holes must play in an enterprise of this kind. And right beside him, very close to his ear, a voice has just said,
"Dark in here, isn't it?"
It began to snow. The barley sugar windows of the cottage showed bright and cheerful against the blackness. At one side of the clearing, three tiny red points of light glowed momentarily, and there was the sound of a chesty cough, abruptly silenced.
"Shut up!" hissed a third-rank wizard. "They'll hear us."
"Who will? We gave the lads from the Brotherhood of the Hoodwinked the slip in the swamp, and those idiots from the Venerable Council of Seers went off the wrong way anyway."
"Yeah," said the most junior wizard, "but who keeps talking to us? They say this is a magic wood. It's full of goblins and wolves and
trees,"
said a voice out of the darkness high above. It possessed what can only be described as timbre.
"Yeah,"
said the youngest wizard. He sucked on his dog end and shivered. The leader of the party peered over the rock and watched the cottage.
"Right then,"
he said, knocking out his pipe on the heel of his seven-league boot, who squeaked in protest.
"We rush in, we grab them, we're away, okay?"
"You sure it's just people?"
said the youngest wizard nervously.
"Of course I'm sure," snarled the leader. "What do you expect, three bears?" "They could be monsters. This is the sort of wood that has monsters."
"And trees,"
said a friendly voice from the branches.
"Yeah,"
said the leader cautiously. Rincewind looked carefully at the bed. It was quite a nice little bed, in a sort of hard toffee inlaid with caramel, but he'd rather eat it than sleep in it, and it looked as though someone already had.
"Someone's been eating my bed," he said.
"I like toffee," said Twoflower defensively.
"If you don't watch out, the fairy will come and take all your teeth away," said Rincewind.
"No, that's elves,"
said Swires from the dressing table.
"Elves do that. Toenails, too. Very touchy at times, elves can be."
Twoflower sat down heavily on his bed.
"You've got it wrong," he said. "Elves are noble and beautiful and wise and fair. I'm sure I read that somewhere."
Swires and Rincewind's kneecap exchanged glances.
"I think you must be thinking about different elves,"
the gnome said slowly.
"We've just got the other sort round here. Not that you'd call them quick-tempered,"
he added hastily.
"Not if you didn't want to take your teeth home in your hat, anyway."
There was the tiny distinctive sound of a nougat door opening. At the same time, from the other side of the cottage came the faintest of tinkles, like a rock smashing a barley sugar window as delicately as possible. "What was that?" said Twoflower.
"Which one?" said Rincewind.
There was the clonk of a heavy branch banging against the windowsill. With a cry of,
"Elves!"
Swires scuttled across the floor to a mouse hole and vanished.
"What shall we do?" said Twoflower.
"Panic," said Rincewind, hopefully. He always held that panic was the best means of survival. Back in the olden days, his theory went, people faced with hungry saber-toothed tigers could be divided very simply into those who panicked and those who stood there saying, "What a magnificent brute!" and, "Here, pussy!" "There's a cupboard," said Twoflower, pointing to a narrow door that was squeezed between the wall and the chimney breast. They scrambled into sweet, musty darkness. There was the creak of a chocolate floorboard outside. Someone said,
"I heard voices."
Someone else said,
"Yeah, downstairs. I think it's the hoodwinkers."
"I thought you said we'd given them the slip."
"Hey, you two, you can eat this place. Here, look, you can..."
"Shut up."
There was a lot more creaking, and a muffled scream from downstairs where a venerable seer, creeping carefully through the darkness from the broken window, had trodden on the fingers of a hoodwinker who was hiding under the table. There was the sudden zip and zing of magic. "Bugger," said a voice outside. "They've got him. Let's go." There was more creaking, and then silence. After a while, Two Flower said, "Rincewind, I think there's a broomstick in this cupboard."
"Well, what's so unusual about that?"
"This one's got handlebars." There was a piercing shriek from below. In the darkness, a wizard had tried to open the luggage's lid. A crash from the scullery indicated the sudden arrival of a party of illuminated mages of the Unbroken Circle.
"What do you think they're after?" whispered Two Flower.
"I don't know, but I think it might be a good idea not to find out," said Rincewind thoughtfully.
"You could be right." Rincewind pushed open the door gingerly. The room was empty. He tiptoed across to the window and looked down into the upturned faces of three brothers of the Order of Midnight.
"That's him!"
He drew back hurriedly and rushed for the stairs. The scene below was indescribable, but since that statement would earn the death penalty in the reign of Olaf Quimby II, the attempt better be made. Firstly, most of the struggling wizards were trying to illuminate the scene by various flames, fireballs, and magical glows, so the overall lighting gave the impression of a disco in a strobe light factory. Each man was trying to find a position from which he could see the rest of the room without being attacked himself. And absolutely everyone was trying to keep out of the way of the luggage, which had two venerable seers pinned in a corner and was snapping its lid at anyone who approached. But one wizard did happen to look up.
"It's him!"
Rincewind jerked back, and something bumped into him. He looked around hurriedly and stared where he saw Two Flower sitting on the broomstick, which was floating in midair.
"The witch must have left it behind," said Two Flower. "A genuine magic broomstick."
Rincewind hesitated. Octarine sparks were spitting off the broomstick's bristles, and he hated heights almost more than anything else. But what he really hated more than anything at all was a dozen very angry and bad-tempered wizards rushing up the stairs towards him, and this was happening.
"All right," he said, "but I'll drive."
He lashed out with a boot at a wizard who was halfway through a spell of binding and jumped onto the broomstick, which bobbed down the stairwell and then turned upside down so that Rincewind was horribly eye to eye with the Brother of Midnight. He yelped and gave the handlebars a convulsive twist. Several things happened at once. The broomstick shot forward and broke through the wall in a shower of crumbs. The luggage surged forwards and bit the brother in the leg. And with a strange whistling sound, an arrow appeared from nowhere, missed Rincewind by inches, and struck the luggage's lid with a very solid thud. The luggage vanished. In a little village deep in the forest, an ancient shaman threw a few more twigs on his fire and stared through the smoke at his shame-faced apprentice.
"A box with legs on?" he said.
"Yes, master. It just appeared out of the sky and looked at me," said the apprentice.
"It had eyes, then, this box?"
"No," began the apprentice, and stopped, puzzled. The old man frowned.
"Many have seen Topaxi, god of the red mushroom, and they earn the name of Shaman," he said. "Some have seen Skelde, spirit of the smoke, and they are called sorcerers. A few have been privileged to see Cheryl, the soul of the forest, and they are known as spirit masters. But none have seen a box with hundreds of legs that looked at them without eyes, and they are known as idiot."
The interruption was caused by a sudden screaming noise and a flurry of snow and sparks that blew the fire across the dark hut. There was a brief blurred vision, and then the opposite wall was blasted aside and the apparition vanished. There was a long silence, then a slightly shorter silence. Then the old shaman said carefully,
"You didn't just see two men go through upside down on a broomstick, shouting and screaming at each other, did you?"
The boy looked at him levelly.
"Certainly not," he said.
The old man heaved a sigh of relief.
"Thank goodness for that," he said. "Neither did I."
The cottage was in turmoil, because not only did the wizards want to follow the broomstick, they also wanted to prevent each other from doing so, and this led to several regrettable incidents. The most spectacular, and certainly the most tragic, happened when one seer attempted to use his seven-league boots without the proper sequence of spells and preparations. Seven-league boots, as has already been intimated, are a tricksy form of magic at best, and he remembered too late that the utmost caution must be taken in using a means of transport which, when all is said and done, relies for its effectiveness on trying to put one foot 21 miles in front of the other. The first snowstorms of winter were raging, and in fact there was a suspiciously heavy covering of cloud over most of the disk. And yet from far above and by the silver light of the Discworld's tiny moon, it presented one of the most beautiful sights in the multiverse. Great streamers of cloud, hundreds of miles long, swirled from the waterfall at the rim of the mountains of the hub. In the cold, crystal silence, the huge white spiral glittered frostily under the stars, imperceptibly turning, very much as though God had stirred his coffee and then poured the cream in. Nothing disturbed the glowing scene, which... Something small and distant broke through the cloud layer, trailing sheds of vapour. In the stratospheric calm, the sounds of bickering became sharp and clear.
You said you could fly one of these things.
No, I didn't. I just said you couldn't.
But I've never been on one before.
What a coincidence.
Anyway, you said, look at the sky.
No, I didn't.
What's happened to the stars?
And so it was that Rincewind and Twoflower became the first two people on the disk to see what the future held. 1,000 miles behind them, the hub mountain of Cori Celesti stabbed the sky and cast a knife-bright shadow across the broiling clouds, so that gods ought to have noticed too. But the gods don't normally look at the sky, and in any case were engaged in litigation with the ice giants who had refused to turn their radio down. Rimwards, in the direction of Great Artuin's travel, the sky had been swept of stars. In that circle of blackness there was just one star, a red and baleful star, a star like the glitter in the eye socket of a rabid mink. It was small and horrible and uncompromising, and the disk was being carried straight towards it. Rincewind knew precisely what to do in these circumstances. He screamed and pointed the broomstick straight down. Golda Weatherwax stood in the centre of the octagram and raised his hands.
Urshalo, Dileptor, Kuhula, do my bidding.
A small mist formed over his head. He glanced sideways at Trumon, who was sulking at the edge of the magic circle.
This next bit's quite impressive, he said. Watch. Kot Bahai, Kot Sham. To me, O spirits of small isolated rocks and worried mice not less than 3 inches long.
What? Said Trumon.
That bit took quite a lot of research, agreed Golda. Especially the mice. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes.
He raised his arms again. Trumon watched him and licked his lips distractedly. The old fool was really concentrating, bending his mind entirely to the spell, and hardly paying any attention to Trumon. Words of power rolled around the room, bouncing off the walls and scuttling out of sight behind shelves and jars. Trumon hesitated. Golda shut his eyes momentarily, his face a mask of ecstasy as he mouthed the final word. Trumon tensed, his fingers curling around the knife again. And Golda opened one eye, nodded at him, and sent a sideways blast of power that picked the younger man up and sent him sprawling against the wall. Golda winked at him and raised his arms again.
To me, O spirits of...
There was a thunderclap, an implosion of light, and a moment of complete physical uncertainty, during which even the walls seemed to turn in on themselves. Trumon heard a sharp intake of breath, and then a dull, solid thump. The room was suddenly silent. After a few minutes, Trumon crawled out from behind a chair and dusted himself off. He whistled a few bars of nothing much and turned towards the door with exaggerated care, looking at the ceiling as if he'd never seen it before. He moved in a way that suggested he was attempting the world speed record for the nonchalant walk. The luggage, squatted in the centre of the circle and opened its lid. Trumon stopped. He turned very, very carefully, dreading what he might see. The luggage seemed to contain some clean laundry, smelling slightly of lavender. Somehow it was quite the most terrifying thing the wizard had ever seen. He said, you wouldn't have seen another wizard around here, by any chance? The luggage contrived to look more menacing. Oh, said Trumon. Well, fine. It doesn't matter. He pulled vaguely at the hem of his robe and took a brief interest in the detail of its stitching. When he looked up, the horrible box was still there. Goodbye, he said, and ran. He managed to get through the door just in time. Rincewind? Rincewind opened his eyes. Not that it helped much. It just meant that instead of seeing nothing but blackness, he saw nothing but whiteness, which surprisingly was worse. Are you all right? No. Ah. Rincewind sat up. He appeared to be on a rock speckled with snow, but it didn't seem to be everything a rock ought to be. For example, it shouldn't be moving. Snow blew around him. Twoflower was a few feet away, a look of genuine concern on his face. Rincewind groaned. His bones were very angry at the treatment they had recently received, and were queuing up to complain. "What now?" he said. "You know when we were flying and I was worried we might hit something in the storm, and you said the only thing we could possibly hit at this height was a cloud stuffed with rocks?" "Well?" "How did you know?" Rincewind looked around. But for all the variety and interest in the scene around him, they might as well have been in the inside of a ping-pong ball. The rock underneath was, well, rocking. He ran his hands over it, and felt the scoring of chisels. When he put an ear to the cold, wet stone, he fancied he could hear a dull, slow thumping, like a heartbeat. He crawled forward until he came to an edge, and peered very cautiously over it. At that moment, the rock must have been passing over a break in the clouds, because he caught a dim but horribly distant view of jagged-edged mountain peaks. They were a long way down. He gurgled incoherently and inched his way backwards. "This is ridiculous," he told Twoflower. "Rocks don't fly. They're noted for not doing it." "Maybe they would if they could," said Twoflower. "Perhaps this one just found out how." "Let's hope it doesn't forget again," said Rincewind. He huddled up in his soaking robe and looked glumly at the cloud around him. He supposed there were some people somewhere who had some control over their lives. They got up in the mornings and went to bed at night in the reasonable certainty of not falling over the edge of the world, or being attacked by lunatics, or waking up on a rock with ideas above its station. He dimly remembered leading a life like that once. Rincewind sniffed. The rock smelt of frying. The smell seemed to be coming up from ahead, and appealed straight to his stomach.
"Can you smell anything?" he said.
"I think it's bacon," said Twoflower.
"I hope it's bacon," said Rincewind, "because I'm going to eat it."
He stood up on the trembling stone and tottered forward into the clouds, peering through the wet gloom. At the front or leading edge of the rock, a small druid was sitting cross-legged in front of a small fire. A square of oilskin was tied across his head and knotted under his chin. He was poking at a pan of bacon with an ornamental sickle.
Said Rincewind.
The druid looked up and dropped the pan into the fire. He leapt to his feet and gripped the sickle aggressively, or at least as aggressively as anyone can look in a long, wet, white nightshirt and a dripping headscarf.
"I warn you, I shall deal harshly with hijackers," he said, and sneezed violently.
"We'll help," said Rincewind, looking longingly at the burning bacon.
This seemed to puzzle the druid, who, to Rincewind's mild surprise, was quite young. He supposed there had to be such a thing as young druids, theoretically. It was just that he'd never imagined them.
"You're not trying to steal the rock," said the druid, lowering the sickle a fraction.
"I didn't even know you could steal rocks," said Rincewind, wearily.
"Excuse me," said Twoflower politely. "I think your breakfast is on fire." The druid glanced down and flailed ineffectually at the flames. Rincewind hurried forward to help. There was a fair amount of smoke, ash, and confusion, and the shared triumph of actually rescuing a few pieces of rather charred bacon did more good than a whole book on diplomacy.
"How did you get here, actually?" said the druid. "We're 500 feet up, unless I've got the runes wrong again."
Rincewind tried not to think about height.
"We sort of dropped in as we were passing," he said.
"On our way to the ground," Two Flower added.
"Only your rock broke our fall," said Rincewind. His back complained. "Thanks," he added. "I thought we'd run into some turbulence a while back," said the druid, whose name turned out to be Bellafon. "That must have been you," he shivered. "It must be morning by now," he said. "Sod the rules, I'm taking us up. Hang on."
"What to?" said Rincewind.
"Well, just indicate a general unwillingness to fall off," said Bellafon.
He took a large iron pendulum out of his robe and swung it in a series of baffling sweeps over the fire. Clouds whipped around them. There was a horrible feeling of heaviness, and suddenly the rock burst into sunlight. It levelled off a few feet above the clouds in a cold but bright blue sky. The clouds that had seemed chillingly distant last night and horribly clammy this morning were now a fleecy white carpet, stretching away in all directions. A few mountain peaks stood out like islands. Behind the rock, the wind of its passage sculpted the clouds into transient whirls. The rock, it was about 30 feet long and 10 feet wide, and bluish.
"What an amazing panorama," said Two Flower, his eyes shining.
"What's keeping us up?" said Rincewind.
"Persuasion," said Bellafon, wringing out the hem of his robe.
"Ah," said Rincewind sagely.
"Keeping them up is easy," said the druid, holding up a thumb and squinting down the length of his arm at a distant mountain. "The hard part is landing."
"You wouldn't think so, would you?" said Two Flower.
"Persuasion is what keeps the whole universe together," said Bellafon. "It's no good saying it's all done by magic."
Rincewind happened to glance down through the thinning cloud to a snowy landscape a considerable distance below. He knew he was in the presence of a madman, but he was used to that. If listening to this madman meant he stayed up here, he was all ears. Bellafon sat down with his feet dangling over the edge of the rock.
"Look, don't worry," he said. "If you keep thinking the rock shouldn't be flying, it might hear you and become persuaded, and you will turn out to be right, okay? It's obvious you aren't up to date with modern thinking."
"So it would seem," said Rincewind weakly.
He was trying not to think about rocks on the ground. He was trying to think about rocks swooping like swallows, bounding across landscapes in the sheer joy of levity, zooming skywards in a... He was horribly aware he wasn't very good at it.
The druids of the disc prided themselves on their forward-looking approach to the discovery of the mysteries of the universe. Of course, like druids everywhere, they believed in the essential unity of all life, the healing power of plants, the natural rhythm of the seasons, and the burning alive of anyone who didn't approach all this in the right frame of mind. But they had also thought long and hard about the very basis of creation, and had formulated the following theory. The universe, they said, depended for its operation on the balance of four forces, which they identified as charm, persuasion, uncertainty, and bloody-mindedness. Thus it was that the sun and moon orbited the disk because they were persuaded not to fall down, but didn't actually fly away because of uncertainty. Charm allowed trees to grow, and bloody-mindedness kept them up, and so on. Some druids suggested that there were certain flaws in this theory, but senior druids explained very pointedly that there was indeed room for informed argument, the cut and thrust of exciting scientific debate, and basically it lay on top of the next solstice bonfire.
"Ah, so you're an astronomer," said Two Flower.
"Oh, no," said Bellafon, as the rock drifted gently around the curve of a mountain. "I'm a computer hardware consultant."
"What's a computer hardware?"
"Well, this is," said the druid, tapping the rock with a sandaled foot. "Part of one, anyway. It's a replacement. I'm delivering it. They're having trouble with the big circles up on the vortex planes. So they say, anyway. I wish I had a bronze talk for every user who didn't read the manual." He shrugged.
What use is it, then, exactly?"
asked Rincewind, anything to keep his mind off the drop below.
"You can use it to tell you what time of year it is," said Bellerophon.
"Ah, you mean if it's covered in snow, then it must be winter?"
"Yes. I mean, no. I mean, supposing you wanted to know when a particular star is going to rise."
"Why?" said Twoflower, radiating polite interest.
"Well, maybe you want to know when to plant your crops," said Bellerophon, sweating a little. "Or maybe..."
"I'll lend you my almanac, if you like," said Twoflower.
"Almanac?"
"It's a book that tells you what day it is," said Rincewind wearily. "It'd be right up your ley line."
Bellerophon stiffened.
"Book?" he said. "Like, with paper?"
"Yes."
"That doesn't sound very reliable to me," said the druid nastily. "How can a book know what day it is? Paper can't count."
He stamped off to the front of the rock, causing it to wallow alarmingly. Rincewind swallowed hard and beckoned Twoflower closer.
"Have you ever heard of culture shock?" he hissed.
"What's that?"
"It's what happens when people spend 500 years trying to get a stone circle to work properly, and then someone comes up with a little book with a page for every day and little chatty bits saying things like, 'Now is a good time to plant broad beans,' and 'Early to rise, early to bed makes a man healthy, wealthy, and dead.' And do you know what the most important thing to remember about culture shock?"
Rincewind paused for breath and moved his lips, silently trying to remember where the sentence had got to.
"Is,"
he concluded.
"What?"
"Don't give it to a man flying a 1,000-ton rock." "Has it gone?" Trumon peered cautiously over the battlements of the Tower of Art, the great spire of crumbling masonry that loomed over Unseen University. The cluster of students and instructors of magic far below nodded.
"Are you sure?"
The bursar cupped his hands and shouted.
"It broke down the hubward door and escaped an hour ago, sir,"
he yelled.
"Wrong," said Trumon. "It left. We escaped." "Well, I'll be getting down then. Did it get anyone?"
The bursar swallowed. He was not a wizard, but a kind, good-natured man who should not have had to see the things he had witnessed in the past hour. Of course, it wasn't unknown for small demons, coloured lights, and various half-materialised imaginings to wander around the campus. But there had been something about the implacable onslaught of the luggage that had unnerved him. Trying to stop it would have been like trying to wrestle a glacier.
"It swallowed the Dean of Liberal Studies, sir,"
he shouted. Trumon brightened.
"It's an ill wind," he murmured.
He started down the long spiral staircase. After a while he smiled, a thin, tight smile. The day was definitely improving. There was a lot of organising to do, and if there was something Trumon really liked, it was organising. The rock swooped across the high plains, whipping snow from the drifts a mere few feet below. Bellerophon scuttled about urgently, smearing a little mistletoe ointment here, chalking a rune there, while Rincewind cowered in terror and exhaustion, and Twoflower worried about his luggage.
"Up ahead!" screamed the druid above the noise of the slipstream. "Behold, the great computer of the skies!"
Rincewind peered between his fingers. On the distant skyline was an immense construction of grey and black slabs, arranged in concentric circles and mystic avenues, gaunt and forbidding against the snow. Surely men couldn't have moved those nascent mountains. Surely a troop of giants had been turned to stone by some...
"It looks like a lot of rocks," said Twoflower.
Bellerophon hesitated in mid-gesture.
"What?"
he said.
"It's very nice," added the tourist hurriedly.
He sought for a word. "Ethnic," he decided. The druid stiffened.
"Nice," he said. "A triumph of the silicone chunk. A miracle of modern Masonic technology. Nice."
"Oh, yes," said Twoflower, to whom sarcasm was merely a seven-letter word beginning with S.
"What does ethnic mean?" said the druid.
It means terribly impressive, said Rincewind hurriedly, and we seem to be in danger of landing, if you don't mind. Bellophon turned around, only slightly mollified. He raised his arms wide and shouted a series of untranslatable words ending with nice in a hurt whisper. The rock slowed, drifted sideways in a billow of snow, and hovered over the circle. Down below, a druid waved two bunches of mistletoe in complicated patterns, and Bellophon skillfully brought the massive slab to rest across two giant uprights with the faintest of clicks. Rincewind let his breath out in a long sigh. It hurried off to hide somewhere. A ladder banged against the side of the slab, and the head of an elderly druid appeared over the edge. He gave the two passengers a puzzled glance, and then looked up at Bellophon.
"About bloody time," he said. 7 weeks to Hog's Watch night, and it's gone down on us again."
"Hello, Zachariah," said Bellophon. "What happened this time?"
"It's all totally fouled up. Today it predicted sunrise 3 minutes early. Talk about a klutz, boy. This is it."
Bellophon clambered onto the ladder and disappeared from view. The passengers looked at each other, and then stared down into the vast open space between the inner circle of stones. "What shall we do now?" said Twoflower.
"We could go to sleep," suggested Rincewind.
Twoflower ignored him and climbed down the ladder. Around the circle, druids were tapping the megaliths with little hammers and listening intently. Several of the huge stones were lying on their sides, and each was surrounded by another crowd of druids who were examining it carefully and arguing amongst themselves. Arcane phrases floated up to where Rincewind sat.
"It can't be software incompatibility. The Chant of the Trodden Spiral was designed for concentric rings, idiot."
"I say, fire it up again and try a simple moon ceremony."
"All right, all right. Nothing's wrong with the stones. It's just that the universe has gone wrong, right?"
Through the mists of his exhausted mind, Rincewind remembered the horrible star they'd seen in the sky. Something had gone wrong with the universe last night. How had he come to be back on the disk? He had a feeling that the answers were somewhere inside his head, and an even more unpleasant feeling began to dawn on him that something else was watching the scene below, watching it from behind his eyes. The spell had crept from its lair deep in the untrodden dirt roads of his mind, and was sitting, bold as brass, in his forebrain, watching the passing scene, and doing the mental equivalent of eating popcorn. He tried to push it back, and the world vanished. He was in darkness, a warm, musty darkness, the darkness of the tomb, the velvet blackness of the mummy case. There was a strong smell of old leather and the sourness of ancient paper. The paper rustled. He felt that the darkness was full of unimaginable horrors, and the trouble with unimaginable horrors was that they were only too easy to imagine.
"Rincewind,"
said a voice. Rincewind had never heard a lizard speak, but if one did, it would have a voice like that.
He said. "Yes?"
The voice chuckled, a strange sound, rather papery.
"You ought to say, 'Where am I?'"
it said.
"Would I like it if I knew?" said Rincewind.
He stared hard at the darkness. Now that he was accustomed to it, he could see something. Something vague, hardly bright enough to be anything at all. Just the merest tracery in the air. Something strangely familiar.
"All right," he said. "Where am I?"
"You are dreaming."
"Can I wake up now, please?"
"No,"
said another voice, as old and dry as the first, but still slightly different.
"We have something very important to tell you,"
said a third voice, if anything more corpse-dry than the others. Rincewind nodded stupidly. In the back of his mind the spell lurked and peered cautiously over his mental shoulder.
"You've caused us a lot of trouble, young Rincewind,"
the voice went on.
"All this dropping over the edge of the world with no thought for other people. We had to seriously distort reality, you know."
"Gosh."
And now you have a very important task ahead of you. Oh, good. Many years ago we arranged for one of our number to hide in your head, because we could foresee a time coming when you would need to play a very important role.
Me? Why?
You run away a lot, said one of the voices. That is good. You are a survivor.
Survivor? I've nearly been killed dozens of times.
Exactly.
Oh.
But try not to fall off the disc again. We really can't have that.
Who are we, exactly? Said Rincewind. There was a rustling in the darkness.
In the beginning was the word,
said a dry voice right behind him.
It was the egg, corrected another voice. I distinctly remember the great egg of the universe, slightly rubbery. You're both wrong, in fact. I'm sure it was the primordial slime.
A voice by Rincewind's knee said,
No, that came afterwards. There was a firmament first. Lots of firmament. Rather sticky. Like candy floss. Very syrupy, in fact. In case anyone's interested,
said a crackly voice on Rincewind's left,
you're all wrong. In the beginning was the clearing of the throat. Then the word. Pardon me, the slime. Distinctly rubbery, I thought.
There was a pause. Then a voice said carefully,
Anyway, whatever it was, we remember it distinctly. Quite so. Exactly. And our task is to see that nothing dreadful happens to it, Rincewind.
Rincewind squinted into the blackness. Would you kindly explain what you're talking about? There was a papery sigh.
So much for metaphor, said one of the voices. Look, it is very important you safeguard the spell in your head and bring it back to us at the right time, you understand? So that when the moment is precisely right, we can be said. Do you understand?
Rincewind thought. We can be said? And it dawned on him what the tracery was ahead of him. It was writing on a page, seen from underneath.
I'm in the octavo, he said. In certain metaphysical respects,
said one of the voices in offhand tones. It came closer. He could feel the dry rustling right in front of his nose. He ran away. The single red dot glowed in its patch of darkness. Trumon, still wearing the ceremonial robes from his inauguration as head of the Order, couldn't rid himself of the feeling that it had grown slightly while he watched. He turned away from the window with a shudder. Well, he said.
It's a star, said the Professor of Astrology. I think.
You think? The astrologer winced. They were standing in Unseen University's observatory, and the tiny ruby pinpoint on the horizon wasn't glaring at him any worse than his new master.
Well, you see, the point is that we've always believed stars to be pretty much the same as our sun.
You mean balls of fire about a mile across?
Yes, but this one is well, big.
Bigger than the sun? Said Trumon. He'd always considered a mile-wide ball of fire quite impressive, although he disapproved of stars on principle. They made the sky look untidy.
A lot bigger, said the astrologer slowly.
Bigger than Great Artuin's head, perhaps? The astrologer looked wretched.
Bigger than Great Artuin and the disk together, he said. We've checked, he added hurriedly, and we're quite sure.
That is big, agreed Truman. The word huge comes to mind.
Massive, agreed the astrologer hurriedly.
Truman paced the broad mosaic floor of the observatory, which was inlaid with the signs of the disk zodiac. There were 64 of them, from Wizen, the double-headed kangaroo, to Gahuli, the vase of tulips, a constellation of great religious significance whose meaning, alas, was now lost. He paused on the blue and gold tilework of Mubbo the Hyena, and turned suddenly.
"We're going to hit it?" he asked.
"I'm afraid so, sir," said the astrologer. Truman walked a few paces forward, stroking his beard thoughtfully. He paused on the cusp of Okjok the salesman and the celestial parsnip.
"I'm not an expert in these matters," he said, "but I imagine this would not be a good thing."
No, sir.
"Very hot, stars." The astrologer swallowed.
"Yes, sir."
"We'd be burned up?"
Eventually. Of course, before that, there would be disk quakes and tidal waves, gravitational disruption, and probably the atmosphere would be stripped away.
Ah. In a word, lack of decent organization.
The astrologer hesitated and gave in.
You could say so, sir.
People would panic.
Fairly briefly, I'm afraid.
Said Truman, who was just passing over the perhaps gate and orbiting smoothly towards the cow of heaven. He squinted up again at the red gleam on the horizon. He appeared to reach a decision.
"We can't find Rincewind," he said, "and if we can't find Rincewind, we can't find the eighth spell of the Octavo. But we believe that the Octavo must be read to avert catastrophe. Otherwise, why did the Creator leave it behind?"
"Perhaps he was just forgetful," suggested the astrologer.
Truman glared at him. "The other orders are searching all the lands between here and the hub," he continued, counting the points on his fingers, "because it seems unreasonable that a man can fly into a cloud and not come out."
"Unless it was stuffed with rocks," said the astrologer, in a wretched and, as it turned out, entirely unsuccessful attempt to lighten the mood.
"But come down he must somewhere."
"Where?" we ask ourselves.
"Where?" said the astrologer, loyally. And immediately a course of action suggests itself to us.
"Ah," said the astrologer, running in an attempt to keep up as the wizard stalked across the two fat cousins.
"And that course is?"
The astrologer looked up into two eyes as grey and bland as steel.
"We stop looking," he ventured.
"Precisely. We use the gifts the Creator has given us, to wit. We look down, and what is it we see?"
The astrologer groaned inwardly. He looked down.
Tiles?" he hazarded.
"Tiles, yes. Which together make up the..."
Truman looked expectant.
"Zodiac?" ventured the astrologer, a desperate man.
"Right. And therefore all we need to do is cast Rincewind's precise horoscope, and we will know exactly where he is."
The astrologer grinned like a man who, having tap-danced on quicksand, feels the press of solid rock under his feet.
"I shall need to know his precise place and time of birth," he said.
"Easily done. I copied them out of the university files before I came up here."
The astrologer looked at the notes, and his forehead wrinkled. He crossed the room and pulled out a wide drawer full of charts. He read the notes again. He picked up a complicated pair of compasses and made some passes across the charts. He picked up a small brass astrolabe and cranked it carefully. He whistled between his teeth. He picked up a piece of chalk and scribbled some numbers on a blackboard. Truman, meanwhile, had been staring out at the new star. He thought, "The legend in the Pyramid of Tsort says that whoever says the 8 spells together when the disc is in danger will obtain all that he truly desires. And it will be so soon. And he thought, I remember Rincewind. Wasn't he the scruffy boy who always came bottom of the class when we were training? Not a magical bone in his body. Let me get him in front of me and we'll see if we can't get all 8. The astrologer said,
oh, gosh,
under his breath. Trumon spun around. Well?
That's a fascinating chart,
said the astrologer breathlessly, his forehead wrinkled.
Bit strange, really,
he said. How strange?
He was born under the small boring group of faint stars, which, as you know, lies between the flying moose and the knotted string. It is said that even the ancients couldn't find anything interesting to say about the sign, which...
Yes, yes, get on with it, said Trumon irritably.
It's the sign traditionally associated with chessboard makers, sellers of onions, manufacturers of plaster images of small religious significance, and people allergic to pewter. Not a wizard sign at all. And at the time of his birth, the shadow of Cori Celesti...
I don't want to know all the mechanical details, growled Trumon. Just give me his horoscope. The astrologer, who had been rather enjoying himself, sighed and made a few additional calculations.
Very well, he said. It reads as follows. Today is a good time for making new friends. A good deed may have unforeseen consequences. Don't upset any druids. You will soon be going on a very strange journey. Your lucky food is small cucumbers. People pointing knives at you are probably up to no good. P.S. We really mean it about druids.
Druids, said Trumon.
I wonder...
Are you all right? Said Twoflower. Rincewind opened his eyes. The wizard sat up hurriedly and grabbed Twoflower by the shirt.
I want to leave here, he said urgently. Right now.
But there's going to be an ancient and traditional ceremony.
I don't care how ancient. I want the feel of honest cobbles under my feet. I want the old familiar smell of cesspits. I want to go where there's lots of people and fires and roofs and walls and friendly things like that. I want to go home.
He found that he had this sudden, desperate longing for the fuming, smoky streets of Ankh Morpork, which was always at its best in the spring, when the gummy sheen on the turbid waters of the Ankh River had a special iridescence, and the eaves were full of birdsong, or at least birds coughing rhythmically. A tear sprang to his eyes as he recalled the subtle play of light on the Temple of Small Gods, a noted local landmark, and a lump came to his throat when he remembered the fried fish stall on the junction of Midden Street and the Street of Cunning Artificers. He thought of the gherkins they sold there, great green things lurking at the bottom of their jar like drowned whales. They called to Rincewind across the miles, promising to introduce him to the pickled eggs in the next jar. He thought of the cosy livery stable lofts and warm gratings where he spent his nights. Foolishly, he had sometimes jibed at this way of life. It seemed incredible now, but he had found it boring. Now he had had enough. He was going home. Pickled gherkins, I hear you calling. He pushed Twoflower aside, gathered his tattered robe around him with great dignity, set his face towards that area of horizon he believed to contain the city of his birth, and with intense determination and considerable absent-mindedness, stepped right off the top of a 30-foot trilithon. Some 10 minutes later, when a worried and rather contrite Twoflower dug him out of the large snowdrift at the base of the stones, his expression hadn't changed. Twoflower peered at him. Are you all right? He said. How many fingers am I holding up?
I want to go home.
Okay.
No, don't try and talk me out of it. I've had enough. I'd like to say it's been great fun, but I can't. And
what? I said, okay, said Twoflower. I'd quite like to see Ankh Morpork again. I expect they've rebuilt quite a lot of it by now.
It should be noted that the last time the two of them had seen the city, it was burning quite fiercely,
a fact which had a lot to do with Twoflower introducing the concept of fire insurance to a venial but ignorant populace. But devastating fires were a regular feature of Morporkian life, and it had always been cheerfully and meticulously rebuilt, using the traditional local materials of tinder-dry wood and thatch waterproofed with tar.
"Oh," said Rincewind, deflating a bit. "Oh, right. Oh, right then. Good. Perhaps we'd better be off then."
He scrambled up and brushed the snow off himself. "Only I think we should wait until morning," added Twoflower.
"Why?"
"Well, because it's freezing cold. We don't really know where we are. The luggage has gone missing. It's getting dark." Rincewind paused. In the deep canyons of his mind, he thought he heard the distant rustle of ancient paper. He had a horrible feeling that his dreams were going to be very repetitive from now on, and he had much better things to do than be lectured by a bunch of ancient spells who couldn't even agree on how the universe began. A tiny dry voice at the back of his brain said,
"What things?"
"Oh, shut up," he said. "I only said it's freezing cold and..." Twoflower began.
"I didn't mean you. I meant me."
"What?"
"Oh, shut up," said Rincewind wearily. "I don't suppose there's anything to eat around here."
The giant stones were black and menacing against the dying green light of sunset. The inner circle was full of druids, scurrying around by the light of several bonfires and tuning up all the necessary peripherals of a stone computer, like ram's skulls on poles topped with mistletoe, banners embroidered with twisted snakes, and so on. Behind the circles of firelight, a large number of plains people had gathered. Druidic festivals were always popular, especially when things went wrong. Rincewind stared at them.
"What's going on?"
"Oh, well," said Twoflower enthusiastically, "apparently there's this ceremony dating back for thousands of years to celebrate the, rebirth of the moon, or possibly the sun. No, I'm pretty certain it's the moon. Apparently it's very solemn and beautiful and invested with a quiet dignity." Rincewind shivered. He always began to worry when Twoflower started to talk like that. At least he hadn't said picturesque or quaint yet. Rincewind had never found a satisfactory translation for those words, but the nearest he'd been able to come was trouble. "I wish the luggage was here," said the tourist regretfully. "I could use my picture box. It sounds very quaint and picturesque." The crowd stirred expectantly. Apparently, things were about to start.
"Look," said Rincewind urgently, "druids are priests. You must remember that. Don't do anything to upset them. But don't offer to buy the stones. But I don't start talking about quaint native folk ways. I thought, really, don't try to sell them insurance. That always upsets them."
"But they're priests," wailed Twoflower. Rincewind paused.
"Yes," he said. "That's the whole point, isn't it?"
At the far side of the outer circle, some sort of procession was forming up.
"But priests are good, kind men," said Twoflower. "At home they go around with begging bowls. It's their only possession," he added.
"Ah," said Rincewind, not certain he understood. "This would be for putting the blood in, right?"
"Blood?"
"Yes, from sacrifices."
Rincewind thought about the priests he had known at home. He was, of course, anxious not to make an enemy of any god, and had attended any number of temple functions, and on the whole he thought that the most accurate definition of any priest in the Circled Sea region was someone who spent quite a lot of time gory to the armpits. Twoflower looked horrified.
"Oh, no," he said. "Where I come from, priests are holy men who have dedicated themselves to lives of poverty, good works, and the study of the nature of God."
Rincewind considered this novel proposition.
"No sacrifices?" he said.
"Absolutely not."
Rincewind gave up.
"Well," he said, "they don't sound very holy to me."
There was a loud blarting noise from a band of bronze trumpets. Rincewind looked around. A line of druids marched slowly past, their long sickles hung with sprays of mistletoe. Various junior druids and apprentices followed them, playing a variety of percussion instruments that were traditionally supposed to drive away evil spirits, and quite probably succeeded. Torchlight made excitingly dramatic patterns on the stones, which stood ominously against the green-lit sky. Hubwards, the shimmering curtains of the Aurora Coriolis began to wink and glitter among the stars as a million ice crystals danced in the disk's magical field.
"Bellophon explained it all to me," whispered Twoflower. "We're going to see a time-honored ceremony that celebrates the oneness of man with the universe. That was what he said."
Rincewind looked sourly at the procession. As the druids spread out around a great flat stone that dominated the center of the circle, he couldn't help noticing the attractive, if rather pale, young lady in their midst. She wore a long white robe, a gold torque around her neck, and an expression of vague apprehension.
"Is she a druidess?" said Twoflower.
"I don't think so," said Rincewind slowly.
The druids began to chant. It was, Rincewind felt, a particularly nasty and rather dull chant, which sounded very much as if it was going to build up to an abrupt crescendo. The sight of the young woman lying down on the big stone didn't do anything to derail his train of thought.
"I want to stay," said Twoflower. "I think ceremonies like this hark back to a primitive simplicity, which..."
"Yes, yes," said Rincewind, "but they're going to sacrifice her, if you must know." Twoflower looked at him in astonishment.
"What? Kill her?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Don't ask me. To make the crops grow or the moon rise or something. Or maybe they're just keen on killing people. That's religion for you." He became aware of a low humming sound, not so much heard as felt. It seemed to be coming from the stone next to them. Little points of light flickered under its surface, like mica specks. Twoflower was opening and shutting his mouth.
"Can't they just use flowers and berries and things?" he said. "Sort of symbolic?"
"Nope."
"Has anyone ever tried?"
Rincewind sighed. "Look," he said, "no self-respecting high priest is going to go through all the business with the trumpets and the processions and the banners and everything, and then shove his knife into a daffodil and a couple of plums. You've got to face it. All this stuff about golden boughs and the cycles of nature and stuff just boils down to sex and violence, usually at the same time." To his amazement, Twoflower's lip was trembling. Twoflower didn't just look at the world through rose-tinted spectacles, Rincewind knew. He looked at it through a rose-tinted brain, too, and heard it through rose-tinted ears. The chant was rising inexorably to a crescendo. The head druid was testing the edge of his sickle, and all eyes were turned to the finger of stone on the snowy hills beyond the circle, where the moon was due to make a guest appearance.
"It's no use you..." But Rincewind was talking to himself.
However, the chilly landscape outside the circle was not entirely devoid of life. For one thing, a party of wizards was even now drawing near, alerted by Trumon. But a small and solitary figure was also watching from the cover of a handy fallen stone. One of the disk's greatest legends watched the events in the stone circle with considerable interest. He saw the druid circle and chant, saw the chief druid raise the sickle, heard the voice.
"I say, excuse me, can I have a word?"
Rincewind looked around desperately for a way of escape. There wasn't one. Twoflower was standing by the altar stone with one finger in the air and an attitude of polite determination. Rincewind remembered one day when Twoflower had thought a passing drover was beating his cattle too hard, and the case he had made for decency towards animals had left Rincewind severely trampled and lightly gored. The druids were looking at Twoflower with the kind of expression normally reserved for mad sheep, or the sudden appearance of a rain of frogs. Rincewind couldn't quite hear what Twoflower was saying, but a few